I love you, man.
I love you too, man.
Yes.
Anyway. Nice. Hi, everybody. I'm Jim.
And I'm Ryan.
And this is the Concept Crucible Podcast.
And man, oh man, do we got a... We got a show, but it's only because it's got backstory. But it's something that really affects the both of us because it's something that we've been doing a lot over the last 2 or 3 years
separately. Erectile dysfunction.
Yeah, and we're here to talk to you about it. And hopefully if the ads work out properly, you would have been primed a moment ago. But anyways,
No,
we're not talking about that, which is a serious problem. But
yes. No, we're actually talking about public speaking.
Yes. Never, ever, ever imagine your audience naked.
I don't actually... I don't know that I'm really good at imagining people naked, so I've never tried.
No, like, I've never done it as a technique for getting over stage fright.
I don't know why it would make me more comfortable.
No, I don't know either. So,
No, the icebreaker. Yes. I'm like, how do we do this? It's super late. We spent an hour and a half in the pre-show for this arguing about the nature of speech acts, which is a totally different podcast. But our icebreaker, Ryan, what is your favorite act of public speaking?
maybe we'll ask that as the question, the question at the end. But I would say my favorite instance of a talk given or a speech delivered to an audience is probably, and it's going to be cliche talking about a TED talk, but Sir Ken Robinson and his discussion or talk on, and his thoughts on education. I know it's cliche to, use TED talks. You know, sometimes TED talks are kind of overused or they're overinflated, but that's just, it's one talk that it proposed a lot of ideas, it contextualized an idea, and it kind of reached out over the ether or the ethernet or whatever and actually spoke to me or touched me in a way, and it inspired a sense of positive forward thinking that yes, you know what, education is not hopelessly lost. It is not something that we can just wash our hands of. We must take responsibility for it, and we must try to work towards a better system. So I would say that's my favorite act of public speaking, or favorite instance of public speaking.
Sure. And we spent so much time arguing about what constituted an act of public speaking in the pre-show that I didn't actually get a chance to think about mine.
Oh.
I was mulling over, like, I've been to a bunch of poetry slams. I really love Beth March and Janice Lee. They're a couple of amazing local poets. I love Copyright Leader and a bunch of bands that I've seen live, but I think best act of public speaking, favorite act of public speaking that I can think of off the top of my head was actually a comedy routine done by a kid from, I don't even know where he was from, I think Mississauga. I saw him at Broken Sword Comedy, which is a local comedy thing here in town. They bring in comedians from sort of Southern Ontario, and they also do a lot of open mic style comedy, and he was about 17. And he killed it. He was like fifth in the night, so he had to go past some pretty good guys to get in there. It was unfortunately all guys, but he's like, yeah, so I'm 17, and these guys are all talking about like their like conquests and like what happens when you're out drinking with your buddies, and I don't have any of those stories. I'm gonna talk about a thing that happened to me in gym class. It was hilarious. He just nailed it. Broken Sword Comedy is a super good time. And I don't know, I love comedy. I don't do any open mic comedy, but I kind of want to try, but I'm always super nervous about it. I guess establishing our street cred, I have given a bunch of talks. I have given talks at Ignite Waterloo. I have given talks in public places. Other than that, and like, I guess random. In headshots, I'm the public speaking guy. I'm the guy who goes places and talks to people about headshots. So places like Nerd Night, and I've never done a Nerd Night talk.
Really?
I just can't think of what I would do it about. But if you would like to see a Nerd Night talk, and you're local to us, you can find the link in the show notes, because they're awesome. Yeah, this is also my chance to plug all the local speaking events.
Yeah, or David Yoon's speakeasy. The next time he runs it, he asked me to speak, but then they had to unfortunately cancel the.
But we will totally link to it because it's super cool.
It is super cool.
But no, the other thing I do that's sort of public, I've done a lot of street performing with juggling and magic and stuff like that, and music. Now with the Riot, we play gigs. We played at Ignite Waterloo. We played at Alta Crea recently. We are exploring some gigs for the new year. We are hopefully going to be playing at the Grand Porch Party in March.
Oh, nice. March,
April? Yeah. I played there once before with when I was playing with a jazz band, the Berliners.
Okay.
And it was super fun. Everybody there was super nice. It brings all these like amazing local musicians out of the woodwork. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it is a great time. And we will hopefully be there. We're still puttering with the application, but I have done a bunch of that stuff. But all of my stuff sort of relates to performance and sort of deliberate public appeals. How about you, Ryan?
Mine's are largely like academic and smaller group. It's public in the sense that there's other people in the room with me, but it's less public in terms of
they don't sell tickets.
No, they sell tickets. Oh, it's okay. It's because they sell tickets for Ignite.
Mm, yeah.
It's more the audience is curated is probably the best way to say it. Like there is a couple common themes as to why the audience is where they are, as opposed to more random assortments of people. I would say. I mean, when you go to Nerd Night or whatever, obviously there's still a group there.
They're nerds.
Yeah, so I mean that would be the closest for me.
Okay, so it's sort of curated by interest. I mean, most talks are curated by interest,
right? Okay, yeah, maybe I'm making a distinction where there is not, but most of my talks tend to be either academic settings or kind of rigid rules governing the talk being given. So I've given talks related to the gambling lab. Talks at work and talks in the sense of like I stand up and speak in front of a group of people to present information. I've done that a couple times at the college, Ignite or Engage, because there's public speaking involved with like presenting your Engage.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah. That's with a group of people, so it's a little bit different as opposed to you being the only person up there. And then for me, the most prominent bit of public speaking is, again, it's a closed forum. But I have a group of buddies who we meet once a month and deliver speeches to each other. And over this past week, as of filming, we had celebrated our 3-year anniversary as a group getting together. So we got together 37 times over the last 3 years.
Nice.
And delivered various kinds of speeches and discussions with each other. We deliver 10-minute speeches that we write ahead of time and deliver and then critique each other. We give 3-minute impromptu speeches. It's like the vamp speech. Your boss is late and you have to go install the room, so you need to speak off the top of your head for 3 minutes, kind of deal. So it's just the morning of, somebody will send you a list of 3 topics and you have to choose one, and over the course of, because obviously we all work during the day, or maybe it's not obvious, but we all work during the day, so you don't really have time to prepare, and then you just go and you have to vamp for 3 minutes.
That's tons of time to prepare for 3 minutes.
It is. It's not nearly as vampy as, say, finding out 20 minutes before you have to speak, which maybe we'll start to do that to challenge ourselves.
20 minutes also seems like I don't know, 2?
Yeah.
We did a neat speaking event here a few years ago. There are some videos about it on the channel, Roulette, where you get up and you give a talk and you don't know what the slides are.
Yeah.
It's super fun.
Yeah. So anyways, within this closed group, I've given a little over a dozen speeches, 2 or 3 3-minute vamps, and then 12 or so, no, more like 8 moderated sessions, where it was basically for an hour I lead a discussion of some kind about some topic that I've arranged ahead of time. So that's my largest bulk experience, and that's where I've had the most practice in terms of standing up in front of people and delivering a pre-prepared set of remarks. So that's my street cred.
That's very, it's very official. so the interesting thing, as we discovered in the pre-show, is that Ryan, you are mostly about technique,
right,
and sort of rhetorical device.
yeah, you use your techniques to be able to reach to the audience. It's all about the various things that you employ in order to deliver, well, to hit your goal, whatever it is. And usually it's in service of either, you know, informing, persuading, or entertaining. But there, okay, that's the goal. The goal is to convey the thing with one of those three intents. And then you have various techniques that you can use to accomplish that goal.
Like what?
There's a lot of different things. I mean, it's first the main one is crafting the speech ahead of time and then knowing it, so you can deliver something that's fairly smooth. Well, reasonably smooth. I mean, various audiences will be forgiving. You know, mm-hmm. like a Toastmasters group will be unforgiving of errors, but be very forgiving of you making it because it's a learning environment, right? Mm-hmm. So they'll be the ones who will actually note when you say ums and ahs, where I find that in a general, like if I'm delivering content to the college, they don't really pick up on the ums and ahs unless it's really bad, as opposed to when I rewatch the podcast, I notice every time I say um and ah.
I don't cut those.
Yeah, no, and it's terrible.
I cut mine.
It's not really a technique per se, but it is. It's just, you know, knowing your speech, knowing your audience, so knowing who's going to be on the receiving end of the public address, and then tailoring tailoring the content or tailoring how you say what you say to them. So if you're going to be delivering a talk to a group of academics, you're going to choose a particular kind of language, you're going to pick a particular level of expertise, or you're going to assume a certain level of expertise. If you're delivering it to a more casual group, you might be more inclined to use more humor to connect or to reach the audience. But you're not going to use humor if you're trying to persuade them on something that they're already opposed to. They would find that, like, generally insulting. Like, these are things that if you take a rhetoric class or if you take a speech communications class, these are things that usually are taught. But it really works out to be true. Like, if you know, like, just as an example, if I'm going to deliver a persuasive speech to an audience that I know is against me and my job is to persuade them, I'm going to use a particular set of limiting criteria in developing my speech, practicing it, and then delivering it to them. You know, I'm not going to be cracking jokes about something that would come across as insulting. I'd be condescending and, you know, things like that. So I want to try to, as much as possible, be able to deliver. I'm really tired. I just realized.
Seems legit.
I know.
No, it's a lot of good technique advice. I did do some speech comm stuff and some rhetoric stuff in university, and it was one of those things where I'm like, I'm gonna lead a life where I have to give a bunch of presentations. If I'm an academic, I should maybe learn something about that. Mm-hmm. And ironically, now I don't lead a life where I have to give a bunch of presentations. I lead a life where I choose to give a bunch of presentations, in live performances and arguably in a podcast with this guy and sometimes other people.
Hello.
But my advice is simpler, unsurprising, given that my whole sort of look at speeches is more elemental. It's don't shift your weight. I mean, don't shift your weight. I do it all the time. You can see it in videos where I will shift back and forth. I am doing that now. If you are listening, you can't hear it because I am stealthy. But I shift my weight from foot to foot, partly because I don't know where I want to stand, partly because I am not looking at the camera. I am looking at the viewfinder, or I am, like, when I do it in a talk, it's because I'm shifting around, looking at the audience and trying to see people and let people know that I can see them. And I move around a lot, probably too much. And this is unsurprising for anybody who plays in my D&D game, where I am everywhere in the room at all times. But it is my speech tick. I shift my weight and move around. And I do that because sometimes I am uncertain, or I am nervous, or I'm just not mindful of it. And the problem with it is it distracts me. I spend more time more and more time to throughout a speech thinking about, am I shifting my weight? Am I moving? Which foot am I on? Why am I on that foot? Why am I not on this foot? Where am I? Let me look at the camera and see where I am. Let me, do these people seem nervous about the way I'm moving? Is that, and it distracts me from what I'm actually doing. It also distracts everyone else from what I'm actually doing.
It's amazing how conscious you become of your body in that moment when you're supposed to be conscious of something else, like speaking or delivering the content.
That's why I love juggling.
But you know what? I disagree with you, Jim, in terms of I don't think the audience necessarily picks up on it as much as you think.
I don't think they do at all.
I don't think people should have the impression here that we're saying that people are always going to pick up. Much in the same way my ums and ahs are not picked up unless it is very pronounced or every other word I'm searching for the next thing and I'm Jeff Goldblum and the thing about speaking is that now I'm turning to Bill Shatner.
I was gonna go with President Obama on that one where he's just sort of
let
me be clear.
Don't
get it twisted. Here's what I'm trying to say.
Are you taking that from Epic Rap Battles? I think that was one of the verses.
I think it was. I was just channeling my inner Alpha Cat there.
Okay.
Alpha Cat, by the way, is a brilliant Obama impersonator who actually met with Obama a while back.
I think I saw.
There's some hilarious footage of him doing his President Obama impression for President Obama. But he played President Obama in the Epic Rap Battles of History. Obama versus Romney, and that I think was from that. But people don't really notice often unless they are speech coaches and things like that who are keenly paying attention to that. In which case, they weren't really paying attention to what you were saying anyway.
No.
But I notice, and I think that they're noticing because I think that I would notice even though I wouldn't actually notice.
Yeah, you almost distract yourself.
I do distract myself. And the virtue of video is that if I'm making a vlog and I distract myself and I find later that that is too distracted, then I just stop, collect my thoughts, and keep going and just cut that part out. Unfortunately, live, that's a lot more challenging.
Yeah.
Although I have definitely stopped. Never in the middle of a song. You never stop in the middle of a song. I did a show once. I forgot an entire verse to a song, and I just sort of kept playing through the chords until Kaylee started looking at me, and I'm like desperately trying to remember the verse that I totally knew like 10 minutes ago, and I just couldn't do it. So I'm just like, you know what? Just roll through to the next verse. Mm-hmm. Never ever stop. Because then people notice.
Mm-hmm.
In public speaking in general, the people are a little more forgiving, especially depending on your atmosphere. I work with Ignite Waterloo, so we get a lot of, part of it is it's informal amateur speakers. It's everybody is welcome to come and speak. And the slides are timed, but we've definitely had people who stop for a second and go, wow, I'm really nervous. And then keep going. And that, admitting that sometimes really helps.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it makes it real, but it also helps people understand and empathize with what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, so the other half of that for me, the gym side of public speaking, is making a connection with the audience, and this doesn't necessarily mean persuading them or carefully, delivering sets of rhetorical devices in such a way that that they find your work compelling or interesting, which may in fact be why very little of my work is compelling or interesting. But
no, I think a lot of your work is compelling and interesting.
Oh, I know. I was fishing for that.
Okay.
But
a lot of his work is compelling and interesting. Quoted.
I'm gonna put that on my book cover one day. A lot of Jim's work is compelling and interesting. Ryan Huckle.
Yeah.
The Jim's, of course, will be in square brackets because it wasn't an actual quote. But no, it's about making a connection with the audience and convincing them or reminding them that I am a real person doing a real thing. Like I said, most of the stuff I do live, half the stuff I do live, I make it all up as I go along. And it's reminding them that I am doing a real thing, and I'm doing it for them, and I can see them and I know that they're there, and I'm aware, I'm trying to be aware of their needs, and that they can see me. And that we this is not a performance. That is, I think, from the discussion we had before, a performance is not something I do for other people. A performance is something I do with other people. Audiences make shows great. Mm-hmm. Like, you can have a good show with a shitty audience. Mm-hmm. But if you have a good audience, you don't have a... And you can have a bad show with a good audience. But, like, if you have a good audience, you can have a great show. Mm-hmm. To speak briefly of my mentor and the wise master of music who I follow intently, Lionel Richie, who I saw in a YouTube commercial once. I did watch the whole commercial. It was an impressive commercial. He was talking about a tour that he had just done in the States, and they had a bunch of people show up in dressed up as Lionel Richie and his old band.
Okay.
And they were in the front row. They were super huge fans. And he's at the point where he doesn't take this stuff too seriously. He doesn't have a lot of people regimenting his tour or anything. He just gets on a stage and sings his songs and does whatever he wants because mm-hmm. he's Lionel Richie, and he seemed really chilled out.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, yeah, so I saw these guys in the front row, and they seemed really cool. So we got them up on stage and got them to help me do a song. And that is what I like doing. I am notorious for doing that. I got Andrew to do a song at Headshots.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime anyone who has played in a band with me is in the same room as me when I'm doing a show, I will attempt to get them up to play a song just because it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And because I like having audience involvement. I like, you know, the audience isn't just the recipient of my performance, whatever it is. They are a part of it, and it is integral to them, and vice versa. But yeah, my actual tip for that is, and this is the advice I give people when we do speech coaching for Ignite, is have a feeling, and then make that feeling come out of your mouth. I mean, we do this all the time. And you only usually get up to speak about something that's really important to you. I mean, even if that is, like, we had a talk, Jay gave a talk on canning. But it was on canning and how to can and what he did, but it was also about how much fun it was to can with his kids. And the sense that you get from that talk, and I will link to it in the show notes because it's a really cool talk, and Jay's a really funny guy. Is not just, oh, well, here's an instructional list of how to can. It is that being a good dad is really important to this guy. And sometimes he loses sight of that. But it is really important to him. And you get that across because that is a feeling that Jay genuinely has. And he does a really good job. I mean, he's also really funny, but he does a really good job of getting that out there. Like, we get talks on all kinds of things, and activism, environmental issues, and but all of it has the same is the same thing in the sense that someone has a feeling, and it is so big that it is overflowing, and they need to, and I'm just like, take that and just let it out in a way that helps other people have that feeling. Because if they get that, like, they're looking for it, then you're laughing. I mean, whether you're giving an academic talk where you're trying to inform people, but you're also trying to convince people that this is a thing that matters. I mean, the big question that anybody is going to ask after your academic talk is, so what? And they had better not need help to get to an answer for that. That is the essential bit, I think, of you know, persuasive speeches.
Mm-hmm.
Is... How do I get this person to have this feeling? How do I get them to understand how I'm feeling and why that matters? And that is as much in performance as it is in content or delivery. Sometimes it is entirely in delivery and in performance. You know, it is the notion that it is okay to let people know that you were nervous or scared.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I did a show once for a senior citizens home. I did magic and juggling and music for an afternoon. It was a lot of fun, and I never played for people in their 80s before. They're a super good time, but they give zero fucks. You're like, wow, and we just get up here, and you get up here, and we get a volunteer, we do a magic trick, and they're like, I am not moving for shit. And it's not because they're crotchety or cranky, it's because they have been on this earth for like 60 years longer than me, and God help it, I will come to them. And I did, and it was a good time, and I juggled cupcakes, and but part of it was just, I had to help them figure out that I was just a guy who was there to help them have a really good time that afternoon, and that we weren't going to do what I wanted to do. We were going to do what they wanted to do, and I was going to make what they wanted to do as entertaining as possible. Mm-hmm. And that is how I wound up juggling cupcakes with and double partners juggling with their rec coordinator. It was a good time. But yeah, that is I don't know, to me it's more about touching an audience than it is about just sort of delivering strategic content, but that shapes a lot of my life in ways that are probably less efficient than they could be. Ryan is our efficiency guy. So what is your secret for touching an audience, sir?
I think I touched on it briefly when we were talking about technique, but really for me it comes down to knowing your audience. And knowing your audience, that can go pretty deep, especially when it comes to things like, well, comedy is a perfect example of it, but also in when you're trying to persuade somebody, knowing what kinds of common experiences you can draw upon. I mean, that's usually one of the reasons why comedy works so well, is because mm-hmm. you can tap into something that almost everybody, not necessarily everybody, but almost everybody in the audience can somehow relate to, comprehend, understand, or has experienced.
That's why we all talk about the weather.
Yeah, because it's something that everybody has some sort of experience with. So when it comes to trying to touch the audience or reach the audience, it really helps if you can somehow, and it's really hard to do when you're walking into it blind, you know, like if you're not preparing a speech for an academic conference kind of deal, you know, I think a lot more of your speaking examples, or when you talked about open mic nights, or not mm-hmm. open mic nights in the slam poetry sense, but open mic nights in terms of going down to a musical venue, you don't necessarily know who's going to come through the door, and it's going to be really hard to, if you're coming prepared for a very receptive audience and you have a very drunk and belligerent audience.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to know your audience in that case. In terms of hostile audiences, I guess it's just going to have to be, you know, your professionalism is just going to have to.
I recommend, like if you're facing an audience of entirely hostile people, I recommend just beatboxing through the whole thing.
Yeah, or just walk off stage. There's no point giving them the time. But I mean, like,
at least give them a decent beatbox performance.
Oh, for sure. But I mean, like, your skill and your practice and whatnot is going to ultimately be what saves you in that one, and just your bold performance.
I think that all of those people, even in a hostile audience, have feelings.
They have feelings, but I don't know. I'm a dick. I largely don't care about feelings. I'm largely distrustful of feelings. I realize that feelings, pathos, has a place. It shouldn't be manipulated, but often, like, you use rhetorical devices to manipulate people's emotions. But I often find myself distrustful of emotions because of the kinds of appeals that can go along with them, and that you can sometimes lose sight of a message because it gets bogged down in emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a dick, and I admit that I'm a dick because of that kind of way of thinking. But I largely...
You heard it here first.
Yeah.
Hawk doesn't care about people's feelings.
It's perhaps a little bit more nuanced than that, but... if you were to ask me or frame the question in that regard, but when it comes to public speaking, you know, I view public speaking largely as performance, and so it doesn't matter what I'm thinking or feeling so much as, am I accomplishing my goal? So am I? That would make me almost the perfect lawyer, because I'd be the perfect shyster lawyer. You know, it's Tom Cruise's line from A Few Good Men, I think it is. You know, it doesn't matter what I believe; it's only matter what I. It only matters what I can prove, kind of.
Yeah.
Deal. So, you know, it doesn't really matter you know, the if I'm delivering a speech, hopefully I agree with it, but you can still deliver a speech in which you don't actually believe.
Sure.
And still,
I mean, but you just, goals. You just have different feelings.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I should probably lay it out. Like, I don't think that we should aspire towards the idea that we should purge emotions altogether. That's factually wrong. We just can't do it. I mean, but it's also the entire history of Western, you know, male philosophy that tries to prize logos over pathos.
Okay, you know. I agree. We should also not strive toward some kind of Vulcan paradise.
There's appeals in there, but yeah, it's I don't know. Maybe we're getting off topic here. Maybe we're just a little too
save
tired.
That for our Star Trek cast.
Yeah.
The one thing we haven't talked about that is worth talking about, and maybe worth talking about first, but I mean, mm-hmm. you know, we've got a lot of context for it, is stage fright.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the number one thing. Whenever I try and get someone up on a stage, there are people who are like super eager, who are like, hell yeah, I got on that stage. Well, you mean to do what? Hold this hat? Drop eggs in it? Yeah, no problem. There are the people who are trusting, which is a street performer thing. Like, people will give you a lot of leeway and let you do things. Like, yes, of course, I'll just, yes, you want to climb on my head? No problem. I'll just do it. It's really cool. I love that space. But there is also, I mean, part of it is also recognizing people who aren't into it and not trying to pressure them into it, because if they feel uncomfortable the whole time, it's not going to be fun for them. It's going to show. It's not going to be fun for the audience. But a lot of people I meet are the people who just sort of quake and are like, I could never do that. And the answer is that, much like juggling, they can. It's just sometimes it's hard. And I understand that. I spent a long time being really self-conscious about making music until one day I was like, fuck, I need to make music. And now I love doing it. Stage fright is a thing that a lot of people get, except for apparently my partner, who is an automaton.
It's not that I have the physiological responses of stage fright, but I don't feel the crippling, I shouldn't use the word crippling. I don't have the, I'm not
debilitated.
I'm not stopped in my tracks and frozen and unable to.
Now, given your previous reference to a Vulcan paradise, what I am hearing when you say that is, Captain, yes, I experienced the physiological responses to stage fright, but
I just learned to ignore them. Yeah, no, largely. Like, that's, even when I was 2 or 3 years into being a karaoke host, the very first bits of getting up on stage and speaking into the mic, queuing up the music and singing, I still had that surge of adrenaline. And I would get the shakes, I would be nervous, my brain would be a little scattered. That's usually the level of stage fright that I experience, and it's the kind that it puts me on the wrong footing to start, because it gets me going and I get really excited. You know, you get little sweaty palms and you get breathing really fast, or it feels like you've been exercising, you know, doing push-ups backstage, and then you walk out and you're slightly out of breath while you're trying to emote and you're trying to get the get your first like sentence right, get it down and pat so you can continue on. And I get all of that, but then after a while things just kind of mellow out and I hit a nice equilibrium where I'm, you know, you kind of get into the zone.
But there's no point at which that stops you from getting on stage, basically.
Yeah, I can't think of any time where it has.
Yeah,
I would be nervous ahead of time. Like, for example, I don't get stage fright getting up on stage. I hate the idea of picking up a phone and calling somebody. That's closer to what I imagine stage fright might be.
I do order all of the pizza.
He does order all, and sometimes it's not online. Sometimes it's on the
phone. I've never ordered pizza on the phone.
No, you have? Oh, really? I guess I just haven't.
I could, but I just do not opt to.
But yeah, like when I was working at a call center and I had to call farmers, you know, I was calling to ask people for their time, like, give me your time to answer my survey questions kind of deal. That gives me pause. But I mean, I was getting paid to do it, so I had to do it kind of deal. Going up to a patron at the bar and telling them, I'm sorry, but it is time for you to leave, that gives me pause going into it. But it doesn't freeze me in my spot. So
it's not performance stuff. That's like individual human interactions.
Yep. Like, there we go. We just solved it.
Your anxiety, the source of your anxiety is not interacting with lots of people. It is interacting with individual people.
Yep. That's totally fair.
Yeah. For me, it's I get tons of stage fright. I still get stage fright. It is not as bad as it used to be because, and for a long time, I sort of thought there was just no way to deal with it. And you didn't deal with it. You just sort of like, you did the thing anyway. Mm-hmm. And you felt sort of brave for doing it like that. Mm-hmm. You just did the thing. And then I did an open mic. My first like real open mic. A few years back, at a poetry slam. And I realized that when I got up there and I like just banged my way through my first song, and it wasn't horrible. I hit all of my notes. I hit most of my chords. I'm sure that it will always be more horrible for me than it was for the people who heard it, who I assume have entirely forgotten it. But, and people were clapping, and I realized that most of the people in there are poets, or the friends of poets, or partners of poets, and they have all been where I was standing, and they were all nervous, and they did the thing that they wanted everyone else in the audience to do, which was to be the biggest fan of the person who's on stage that they could be. And no matter how badly I did, they were all going to be my biggest fans, because they were aware that that is what I needed. And I felt safe. My second song was great. I did actually, we do have a video of a song I did play at the Poetry Slam a couple years ago now, which you can find in the show notes. And they were a super good time during that too. That was one of my VidCon open mic application videos. I played the archaeology song. Mm. But I highly recommend, if you have a lot of problems with stage fright, don't not do public speaking or performance or things like that. If you want to do it, do it. But find a safe space to do it. Open mic nights are not safe spaces. No. Comedy open mics, music open mics, just anywhere. There's no guarantees. Places I recommend are things like events like Ignite, which are structured, partly because I'm totally plugging Ignite, but partly because one of the things we do locally with Ignite is we sit down with speakers and we help them work on their talks. Mm-hmm. We help them refine their talks. We help them get across what they're trying to say, especially because it is a more structured format. But we also we work one-on-one with them. We're happy to review drafts of slides. Like you have a crew of people who have seen a bunch of these talks and who are willing to work very closely, because we want to give people the best show that we can. Mm-hmm. Poetry slams are really great for that, because it is hard to be a giant dick at a poetry slam. I mean, it's not really that hard. I've seen people do it, but it's hard to get up on stage and be a giant dick at a poetry slam without them straight kicking your ass out. I think I saw one misogynist poem at a poetry slam. It wasn't here in town. He lasted like 15 seconds, like past that, and he was just like, "Ladies," and I'm like, and everybody was just like, "All right, you're done." But yeah, safe spaces. Toastmasters groups. We mentioned Toastmasters briefly, and Toastmasters is a group. I am not actually a member, but I have a bunch of friends who are. Mm-hmm. And you know, it is designed for people who enjoy public speaking and who want to learn more about it and who want to work on it together. I don't think anybody really there involved in most groups is like a professional public speaker or anything. You have a bunch of principles and things. It's not that expensive, and you sort of work on it together every week. And it is really cool, and they are really supportive, because again, it is a situation where everybody has been in that seat, mm-hmm. and as soon as you understand that they've been there, it helps make you less nervous. Mm-hmm. Because you know the fear for me is always that the audience does not understand how afraid I am, or they do not understand what I feel, and I'm trying to get that across. And that is why having a feeling and getting it out there is the most important thing, because if they understand how I feel, even if I feel hopeful and scared, they can accept that. They can understand that I am scared, and they can understand that why I am scared, and hopefully we can establish a bond about that, rather than sort of trying to cover it up and soldier on through, which I am notoriously bad at. Super good at hiding feelings. But yeah, if you have given a talk or a performance or something like that, I want to see it. I want to see it in the comments. I want to see your cool things. As always, we want to see your cool things.
Yeah,
For sure. So yeah, leave us a talk. Leave us your talks and your performances, even if they're boring. Especially if they're boring.
I have a really cool idea.
What's that?
Why don't we link my Ignite talk over my face and one of your Ignite talks over your face?
Because I did two.
Yeah, you can maybe split it up and down. Yeah. So maybe
the magic of editing.
That could be our way of sharing or starting the conversation by sharing an instance of where we...
Oh, man. My first Ignite talk is so bad. It's good. I like it. But looking back on it, every time, like, if people will occasionally link it to me, and I'll be like, oh, yep, I did that. The juggling was great.
Yeah.
The breathing and the shifting back and forth, and the fact that I was married to a mic stand that wasn't attached to me or doing anything was the straight worst. But yes, I think that's a great idea. So yeah, you can find our Ignite Talks back when they were over our faces. You can also find them in the show notes. By all means, give them a watch. But yeah, I really want to see your cool stuff, because part of it is the more people who share it, the more people who see it, the easier it is to be okay with it. Mm-hmm. And the more supportive voices you can get for it. And we are nothing if not supportive voices.
We want you to be awesome.
We want everybody to be awesome. I don't know about awesome. I do know about awesome, and I do want everybody to be awesome, but I don't really want to be awesome so much as just a teensy bit braver than I was 5 minutes ago. And if I can just keep that up, well, then eventually I'll hit awesome at some point.
I just want everybody to be awesome. Stay awesome. That's awesome. You know what? You can say I'm devaluing the word, but...
But awesome, whatever. Awesome.
Awesome. That's what it is.
Anyway, I suppose with that, we should do an awesome sign-off. So I'm Jim.
And I'm Ryan.
And this has been the Concept Crucible Podcast.
Stay awesome. Please tell me we've gotten, like, the entire...
No, none of it. None of it. That whole pre-show... where, like, we nearly came to blows.
Ephemeral and lost to the ether.
Gone.
It's too bad, but I suppose our friendship will live on because of it. I love you, man.
I love you too, man.